ask Dennis to keep me on time here because I probably have far more slides than I can probably even talk about today. I work for the USDA, ARS, in El Reno, Oklahoma. It's the Grazing Lands Research Lab. And we're probably going to take a little different emphasis. We're probably going to be a little heavy on the animal side right now rather than on the plant side. But this work stems out of some things. It actually began this lab in the late 1970s with Dr. Sam Coleman and a group of others scattered across the United States when they were looking at developing benchtop NIRS systems for assessing forage quality. The reason that forage quality is so important, particularly in our, well, in any place, but particularly for free-ranging animals, or any animal for that matter, is that the quality of the forage, of course, affects milk production, winning percentages, reproduction, maintenance of health, and ultimately meat on the bone. The Southern Plains region of the United States is a tremendously important region in terms of the beef cattle industry. This millions of cattle pass through Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas on their way to the feedlots out in the High Plains. But they spend a fair amount of time in the Southern Plains grazing forages, winter wheat, and then once we get past that gap period, they're turned out onto warm season pastures. And the important part there is that we want to keep track of the forage quality. The Southern Plains serves as a buffer region for this steady supply of meat from the cow-calf operators to when it ends up in the store for purchase. So this work I'm talking about is really born out of an importance of being able to track forage quality. When we talk about forage quality, of course, the most accurate method would be that in the laboratory, the methods of Van Soest and others. Those methods are the baseline which we measure against. They're costly. They do generate chemical waste products. It can be time-consuming, and often the information that you need doesn't get back into your hands in order for you to make any adjustments on the landscape. And that's what gave rise to the development of the benchtop NIRS system application for forage quality. It's less expensive overall. Right now it's basically the current method of choice, but it still requires sample collection and preparation and processing, and the timeliness of the results is still a question depending upon what lab you may be dealing with. This particular approach is a remote sensing approach. You see in the bottom left-hand corner there an absorbent spectra that's generated from such a device. We take those spectra, we perform mathematical treatments on those spectra, we correlate those with or regress those against the measurements from the laboratory, develop predictive equations, and improve those equations as time goes on. But the question begs itself in terms of why bring the field to the laboratory, why not take the laboratory to the field? And so our starting point was basically, in our first experiment here, was basically just to ask ourselves a question: what is the feasibility of assessing forage quality in the field in real time? Now, the three main forage quality variables that I'm going to be talking about today are going to be nitrogen, or its corollary, crude protein, which is nitrogen times 6.25. Also something called neutral detergent fiber, which represents the indigestible and slowly digestible parts of the cell walls of the plants: cellulose, hemicellulose, lignin, and ash. Animal scientists use NDF as a measure of intake potential, that is how much forage the animal will eat. The third variable I'll be talking about this morning or be referencing will be acid detergent fiber, which is used to calculate digestibility. Again, this is a subset of neutral detergent fiber where we're looking mostly at cellulose, lignin, and silica. In this particular experiment, we began in 1999 and we continued it for 3 years. We took about 100, well, we took a lot of spectra. We ended up analyzing 107 of them. We used an old SC590. Anybody know what those are? Anybody here use one of those? Probably Craig and maybe Ray. They don't make these anymore, but this is all we had available to us. And back in the early 1990s when this was purchased, this was about a $20,000 instrument. So prices have come down since then. But 252 wavelengths it samples in from 350 to about 1,100 microns in about 10 nanometer band centers along that spectrum. Has a 15 degree field of view. We typically mounted it on that gator with an arm a couple of meters above the surface. and we collected samples weekly from four Bermuda grass varieties, Midland, Ozark, World Feeder, and Midland 99. Our pastures were split into three subplots, and they were fertilized with 1X, 2X, and 3X treatments of fertilizer to help foster changes in nitrogen and nitrogen response. We took about, within each of those subplots, we took about 8 to 10 samples for our study. The vegetation underneath the area that we sensed with remote sensor was clipped, it was dried, it was ground through a Wiley mill. It was also scanned by way of a benchtop NRS system to give us a source of comparison. Used standard chemical analysis in the laboratory to get the N, NDF, and ADF values. Over those 3 years, due to instrument problems and weather problems as well, we only had about 107 spectra that we could look at. We assigned 77 of those randomly to a calibration data set and reserved the other 30 for validation of the development of the equations. The spectra themselves were converted into absorbent spectra. We used the techniques that are common to benchtop systems. We did a standard normal variate scatter correction on it. We detrended it, took the first derivative of it, and smoothed it as well. Now, we treated the benchtop NRS spectra exactly the same way, so for reference purposes here. We used modified partial least squares to develop the prediction equations in the data set. Then we tested those equations in the validation data set, and this is what we found out here. When we look at the NIRS and the radiometer, which is our handheld approach, if you look at the means and standard deviations for each of those three forage quality variables there, you'll see that we're very close to laboratory values. The standard errors of prediction were lower for NIRS as we would have expected, but the radiometer approach wasn't that far off. The biases were also low for both methods, though they tend to be a little bit higher for the radiometer approach. If we look at these next three graphs, this would just be the plot of the estimates of nitrogen NDF and ADF from either the NIRS benchtop system or from the radiometer approach. The important thing here, I just want to point out, are the R squares. NRS is higher, of course, than the radiometer approach, but the radiometer approach is pretty good, explaining 76% of the variability in the data. For the NDF, we decreased some with the R-squared down to about 0.63, and for ADF, about 0.69. My co-authors on the paper, who are mostly animal scientists, got pretty excited about that, and I said, that's information that we can use for some of our grazing trials. Well, out of this particular study, we felt like it is feasible to assess at least these three forage quality variables using hyperspectral radiometry. We did use Bermuda grass canopies in every case here. Our canopies were closed for the most part, so that eliminated any background contribution from soil litter or leaf litter, which would have to be accounted for ultimately in an equation. We also recognized, and the point was already made earlier by question, is that the extension of this method needs to be tested against other warm season grasses and other cool season grasses as well. But the point I want to make here at the bottom line here is that we wanted to test these equations to see how we might be able to use it in terms of managing animals, which is really that last bullet there on that slide. So that moves me into the second experiment I want to talk about this morning, which is protein supplementation. Basically, there are two major factors which limit weight gain in grazing, free grazing animals. That would be the energy content of that forage and also its protein content. And we're going to be talking about the protein content here in this particular experiment. Let me introduce, first of all, what a typical grazing season is like in central Oklahoma, where we're located. As I said, the cattle are normally grazing winter wheat in the southern plains. There is a forage gap there from when they have to come off the wheat if you want to use it for grain. and to the point when the warm season grasses are available. Now, typically, the warm season, there's enough biomass available late May, early June, Oklahoma, to turn these cattle out onto these paddocks. The tacit assumption is that the baseline value of about 8% crude protein is available and will remain so until early July, at which point stockmen will start supplying crude protein supplements to their cattle. Now, 2001 was not a typical year in Oklahoma. By the time we turned the cattle out onto these paddocks on June 1, the crude protein content was already at or below the baseline value. And what happened that year, my animal scientist friend said, this year was just backwards. All of our cattle lost weight in the first half of the grazing season in 2001, but gained weight in the last half when we provided supplements. Just backwards what you would expect. Well, the reason was because the crude protein content of these forages was below what we expected. So the bottom line there is, had we had a quick way to determine what was going on with those particular paddocks that we were grazing, we would have been able to do something with our cattle. That is, we could supplement them right away, or we could just sell them. Now, that's going to be market dependent, but those are some of the things that you can do. So what we did is we stated this objective. We wanted to determine if we could use remotely sensed estimates of crude protein as a trigger to signal to us when we should start supplying supplements to our free grazing cattle. We also wanted to compare this particular approach against a more accepted approach, which would be the benchtop NRS fecal analysis for nitrogen content. So what we had, of course, were several paddocks available to us. These measured about 3.2 hectares in size. Essentially the same places where we gathered the data to develop the calibration equations. We went back to these pastures. Each pasture was subdivided by a hot wire into two sub-paddocks. On one side of the hot wire, we assessed forage quality with remote sensing. On the other side, we used the benchtop fecal analysis system to tell us what was going on in that pasture. You see the particulars there. I don't want to go necessarily into all of those, but we did this study in 2003, 2004, and in 2005. Again, the remotely sensed data and the vegetation data were collected in essentially the same way described earlier. The fecal samples were collected about every 2 weeks from each of those pastures. There were 4 to 5 fresh piles that had to be sampled, and they were done every 2 weeks. And I'm glad that our animal scientist friends were the ones taking care of that. I didn't have to worry about that. Those samples were then shipped overnight down to Texas A&M University at the GAN lab, Grazing Animal Nutrition Lab, for them to conduct the analysis. I think I have a slide out of sequence here, but this particular graphic here shows how the three methods sort of tracked with each other for this particular Ozark Lemurgrass paddock. You'll see that things kind of bounce around a little bit. By and large, the remote sensing approach mimicked fairly well what was going on in actuality compared to the lab analysis, and the fecal analysis did a pretty good job too, that there are places where, of course, there are some busts along the way. If we confine our attention here just to the beginning of the grazing season, and we compare, if we look at these things, these values in the columns only here just for a second, we're looking within methods, we see that the remote sensing system ranked the average crude protein content at the beginning of the season pretty much the same way that the lab did. The benchtop near-infrared system didn't come out quite as well, at least at the beginning of the season. But as I said, as the season goes along, things kind of bounce around, and they tend to average out. What was interesting here, though, is that the benchtop system, the fecal analysis system, did not see any statistical difference among the four varieties, whereas the laboratory value and the remote sensing value did detect differences. If we look within a variety but across the methods, We see that the remote sensing approach overestimated the world feeder and the 74-12-12 experimental variety, but underestimated the Ozark when compared to the lab. On the other hand, the fecal analysis approach underestimated world feeder and overestimated both Midland and 74-12-12. So this tells you that both approaches need some refinement in terms of these equations that would be applied to these Bermuda grasses. But getting back to the question of a trigger, if we look at all the data for all 3 years, we found that both the fecal analysis approach and the remote sensing approach signaled when the CP content dipped below 7% at the same point in each of the grazing seasons. So they both can be used as tools to signal when crude protein should be supplied to these free grazing cattle. Now, during our experimental studies, 2003, 2004, and 2005, we did not start at the traditional date. We started progressively later each grazing season. And that was based upon our visual observation of the paddocks. Was there enough biomass there? We had some dry springs, so which delayed our putting the cattle out onto these pastures. So keeping that in mind, we see here that when we look at remote sensing as a tool here to signal when supplements should begin, we found that we should start 6 days earlier in 2003 than just the basic starting at the midpoint of the grazing season. But in 2004, 2005, we found that we could start supplementing later than expectations, 5 days later in 2004, 14 days later in 2005. Now, let me put this back in context. If I go back and do it the way it's typically done in Oklahoma, that is turn cattle out on June 1 and provide supplements on July 1, that's just flying by the seat of the pants, which is typically what's done. Then what these tools told us is that in 2003, we could start supplementing 22 days later than what's typically done, flying by the seat of your pants. 38 days later in 2004 and 47 days later in 2005. In 2005, one of my co-authors was getting extremely nervous because we had not supplied supplements yet, because the conventional wisdom says you do it early July. And here we were already into August and we hadn't done it yet. So this could amount to a considerable cost savings. Now, when we did this little economic analysis here a few weeks ago, actually a few months ago, we were figuring that it would cost us about 13 cents per head per day to supplement too early. So in 2003, it would cost us $2.86 a head too much, whereas in 2005, $6.11 is what it would cost us if we supplied supplements too early. Before I left the lab last week, one of my co-authors, Dr. Bill Phillips, went back and recalculated this figure, and due to increases in feed costs, this has just doubled. So you can see there's a potential here for some tremendous cost savings if we can perfect this technology. Overall, what did we find? We found that remote sensing compared well to the more established fecal analysis approach. We believe that the remote sensing approach is more timely, and it doesn't require the forward sample collection once the equations are built. One thing, though, about the remote sensing approach, it samples the whole sward, whereas animals selectively graze, so there has to be some compensation there of what you think the animals are doing. We didn't address this completely in this talk this morning, though, but there is some indication, though, that both the fecal analysis approach and the remote sensing approach are probably going to have to be adjusted, you know, for these differences in varieties when we apply these calibration equations. Okay, the third study here that I want to talk about is an intake study. Animal scientists typically use ADF to calculate how much intake an animal, how much forage an animal would intake. It's a calculation. But we wanted to see if we could get at it more directly. The reason being is that there's a lot of uncertainty in the actual nutrient deficiencies because of the difficulty estimating forage intake in free grazing animals. That is, you just can't follow them around and measure everything that they do. So our objective then was to evaluate the potential for estimating forage intake on the pasture in real time using hyperspectral forage canopy reflectance. briefly, what this particular experiment is a cut and carry experiment. Very time consuming, labor intensive in order to get this kind of information. Again, the remote sensing data and the vegetation data were, the remote sensing data was collected pretty much the same way we described earlier. But the vegetation data now required us clipping larger paddocks so we could supply, collect enough biomass to supply the animals that we were that were using our model here. The study I'm talking about this morning or this afternoon was conducted in 2005. We have also done things in 2006, 2007, but I'm only reporting for 2005. We had four pastures of common Bermuda grass. We subdivided these pastures into eight subplots. We had four genotypes of sheep with three replicates of each genotype. In essence, one pasture was assigned to four lambs, so each subplot was associated with one lamb, so we kept accurate track of what was going on. The remotely sensed data were collected in each subplot. Each subplot was then harvested, bagged, and weighed before we fed it to the animals. And then we would go back a day later, and then we would weigh what's left, that is amount refused, so we could calculate then how much intake the animals going through. The way we structured the experiment, we fed the odd-numbered subplots on the first day of the cut, and then we fed the even-numbered subplots on the second day of the cut. And this allowed us to get two 24-hour estimates of intake each week for each lamb, and we did this over the course of 9 weeks. The spectra and associated intake measurements were analyzed in SAS using the Maxar, multiple regression, and PLS approaches. Mike Brown, a colleague of mine who's an animal geneticist and a statistician, analyzed the data. We removed breed effects, time effects, and we were only looking at ewe lambs, so there's no gender effects here, gender differences. And the graph I'm going to show you next is basically just it's just 1 year of data. So it's preliminary, and this is just a conceptual study at this point. And what we did here is, of course, is that we developed the prediction equations from the data set, and then we use those prediction equations back on the same data set to see how tight the relationships might be. If we had scattered all over the place, then we would have said, well, let's don't go any further. But because of these tight relationships here, this told us that there's some promise in using remote sensing to predicting intake. Now, this particular graph I'm showing you here is a 60 wavelength model, though the PLS approach, which uses all wavelengths, had an R-square of 0.98. We're in the process now of looking at the 2006 and 2007 data. We're anticipating repeating this at least one more time. How am I doing? Okay. The last thing I want to address this morning is the broadband estimation. Everything I've talked about up to this point has used every single wavelength that we measured, the 252 wavelengths. One of the things that we're interested in doing is seeing if there's a way that we can develop a less costly sensor that we can get into the hands of the producer, which would enable him to do some of these very same things. So now we're moving into the broadband approach. And so the objective here was basically to identify a few wave bands or a combination of wave bands that can be used to estimate these forage variables, plus a couple of other ones that will show up here in just a second. Again, going back to our Bermuda grass data set, using data from 2002, 2003 study periods, here we're using data from an ASD field spec. This is not the SC590 data. Divided the data set into two, a calibration data set and a validation data set, both having an N size of 72. The mathematical treatments that we performed on these spectra was we were simply looking at the simple reflectance, then we looked at some simple vegetation indices. We did an absorbance calculation, which is essentially the log of 1 over the reflectance, and then we did first derivatives of both the reflectance and the absorbance spectra. Look at this with multiple regression and partial least squares as well. Cutting to the chase here, the results, if you look at the calibration data set, in terms of NDF and ADF, any vegetation index that we looked at if we just looked at the raw spectra, if we looked at the first derivative of the spectra, or we did the max R on the spectra, or the max R on the derivative of the spectra, we couldn't do very well for NDF and ADF at all. We did a lot better for crude protein, which we expect. And with the success of precision agriculture in terms of nitrogen, this is not an unexpected thing. We did look at biomass in this particular approach, and we got an R-square of 0.67 in the calibration data set. And this crude protein availability, which is essentially crude protein expressed on a biomass basis, dry biomass basis, we got a 0.76. We took those equations then and applied them to the validation data set. Again, NDF and ADF, there's really not much of a chance of doing anything in a broadband sense, at least the way we looked at it. Crude protein did well. Biomass, okay. But the crude protein availability had a pretty high R-square of 0.81. So in summary here, I think we demonstrated that it's feasible to estimate forage quality in the field using handheld hyperspectral radiometry. We also demonstrated that we think we can use this remote sensing approach at least as a trigger to tell us when we might be able to start supplementing cattle, free grazing stockers, at least in southern plains. Hyperspectral radiometry is being evaluated in terms of estimating forage intake of free grazing animals. Our preliminary results are encouraging, but we still have two more years of data to assess yet, and the truth is yet to be known on that particular thing. But the important thing about that particular estimate of intake is that if we're successful in doing that, we can start moving into this idea of precision supplementation to help improve the bottom line of the producer. We did investigate some multispectral approaches. Some diagnostic wave bands and ratios were identified, but again, the general applicability of these equations to other locations has yet to be demonstrated. Some of the wavelengths, however, that were used in some of these multi-band approaches were in the SWIR region. And what that means essentially is that if you were to produce a multi-band radiometer, that ups the cost in that SWIR. Again, we need to account for the soil and the litter background effects on our equations and to further test the genotype species differences that may exist as well. We believe that that this particular approach can also be used to map the nutritional landscapes. There was talk about this morning about some geostatistics sort of things, plot nutritional contours, and those sorts of things. In terms of extensive grazing systems like we have in the southern plains, just being able to keep track of what's going on with the forage quality can help you assess where you are in terms of, do I provide supplements or do I not? Do I jettison my cattle now, or do I wait to see what's going to happen? If you happen to be in a creep rotational system or an intensive grazing system where you're rotating the cattle around from pasture to pasture, this could be used to help time that. We also believe that this can be used in terms of hay cutting. When would be the best time to cut for hay? So I believe I'm going to leave you with that, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to entertain those. Yes, sir. Well, I think it's a matter of knowing how much is there to begin with and then knowing how much to supply. I think it just helps hone in some things a little bit better. You still don't know exactly, if you knew what ADF and NDF were, you still don't know necessarily how much those stockers would be eating. And that's the purpose of the intake part, is to get at how much are they actually eating.
Yep. One is to predict digestibility and one to predict.
Right.
So, I mean, they're both related. If you do a great job of predicting intake, why are you concerned about ADF and NDF?
Okay, well, the ADF, which is associated with intake, that's a calculated quantity and it's considered the least accurate approach. So if we can get at it more directly, that's just a better precision, I think.
Okay.
At least that's what my animals say.
I think we're saying the same thing.
Okay, all right. You're asking a question, I'm making a statement. So
what I'm saying is drop the ADF and NDF, you don't need it.
Right, I'd agree with you. Okay, I'm on the same page as you are now. Anybody else?
I've got a couple. Going back to, you were looking at several wavelengths, like 60 all at once, right? Is that correct?
In the intake model, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do a stepwise regression to see if, you know, maybe just a handful of those?
That was done with MaxR, and Dr. Brown just, he went through the 60 wavelengths. Now, we did back it off and became less accurate. Mm-hmm. When you had fewer wavelengths, of course, you would do that.
But it was, the primary drivers of that was the ones that were in the shortwave infrared. Is that
on that particular study, I don't remember. Now, that table that we had up there was for a different study. But I don't remember the exact wavelengths for that 60 model.
So I guess my question is, what I'm getting at is, if we could design a sensor that included maybe only one or two near-infrared wavelengths, bands, do you think we could come close to the results of the success that you've had?
Well, I think the answer to that is yes, because in the SWIR region, that's where the chemistry takes place. And these other areas that we're looking at, it's like a second and third overtone. So it's that's what the benchtop near-infrared system would do, is looking more at the chemistry, because it gives more weight, it's more going on in those upper wavelengths. So, yeah, the answer is yes, but I don't know about the cost, you know, what that would mean.
Especially in the short wave, those are really...
And typically that's what's been holding remote sensing back in agricultural applications, is the cost.